I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Arguments over healthcare have dominated American politics for years, but when it comes to mental health, our public discourse is less robust. Today, we bring those concerns to the forefront, first, in a context that is all too familiar. We'll hear about a recent police shooting in the Northland and get some sense for how police handle 911 calls involving those with mental illness. Then, we take a broader look at the state of mental health care in the Metro in a conversation with the leaders of local agencies. In their work to improve the lives of Kansans and Missourians who live with mental illness, where are they succeeding and what more needs to be done? We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Talk about healthcare has dominated political conversation and news coverage for years. Federal lawmakers debate Obamacare, state legislators debate Medicaid expansion. But mental health care is far less discussed. It comes up after mass shootings, with gun rights supporters calling for more attention to mental health as a way of addressing the problem. And it came up last month here in Kansas City when police shot and killed a 28-year-old woman in the Northland who was running around half naked in a bridesmaid dress and wielding a decorative Japanese sword. Later in the show, we're talking with those who oversee community mental health services for several counties in the metro to find out how people get or fail to get the care they need. But we'll begin with part of a conversation from last month. Host Steve Kraske spoke with Dennis Kenny, a professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, about how police deal with the mentally ill, and Grant Bratton, a neighbor who witnessed the confrontation with the woman in the Northland.
Grant, I'd like to begin with you and have you tell us what you saw on Thursday, because you had just put lunch on the table for your three kids when there was a knock on the door. How much information were you given about what was happening and who was at the door?
Yeah, so at that point, it was a little after one, I heard the knock on the door. I went to the door. It was one of the officers, and he just told me, hey, there's somebody in your neighbor's house. Shouldn't be in there. We think that she's wielding a sword. Just don't come outside for any reason. And then my kids came up around my back to see who was at the door. And he goes, okay, you're a father. Here's what I would suggest. Take your kids to the highest, farthest point away. Because he said, I don't know what's in that house. I don't know if she can get a hold of a firearm or if she has one. We don't want it to turn into a gunfight. So get up there and get far away.
I'm wondering, Grant, when did you first catch sight of Ashley Simonetti here that afternoon?
Yeah, so she had been in the house for about an hour and a half, and when she had bolted from the house, she actually ran around behind my house, not in my backyard, but around my backyard, and that was the first time I actually saw her face. I saw that she was wearing that dress that had kind of fallen off and that she had had the sword in her hand.
Did you recognize her?
I did not recognize her.
Yeah. What did you make of her behavior?
It was very erratic. It was clear to me that she was not thinking clearly. She had actually gone to the house behind me and tried to bang on the door and open that door. And she was, you could tell she was just not really thinking clearly.
Erratic might
be a
good
word. Yeah, very erratic, yeah.
You know, she ended up holed up in the detached garage that I mentioned behind a burned out house. This is up in the 3800 block of North Jackson Avenue. I'm just wondering, were you able to follow all of her movements throughout the neighborhood?
I was, actually. She ran, the only part of it that I missed is when she ran around my backyard. At that point was when they fired, I don't know if it was the rubber bullets or the beanbags, but they were firing to disable her at that point. And once I heard gunshots at that point, I laid down on top of my kids on the bed just in case. And that was the only point that I missed, was her running on the other side of my house to get to that garage. As soon as that was over, then I saw, them going to the garage.
How many police officers would you estimate were on the scene?
My guess would be 15 or 20.
Wow.
That might be a conservative estimate, but 15 to 20, I would say.
Okay. Professor Dennis Kenny, I'd like to get your thoughts here. What do you make of what you've heard so far here in our conversation?
It sounds strange. It's obviously an unusual situation. I'm not familiar with any that are similar to it. It's a little difficult from what I've heard and what I've read to be able to reach any decisions as to right. police response.
You know, when you have 15 or 20 officers showing up, does that sound like the kind of response you would get in a situation like this?
That actually is good, particularly when they had a barricaded suspect. You want to be able to control the scene. That's one of the critical elements.
And by controlling the scene, that means what? Surrounding the house or the place where she has holed up?
Well, the idea is that you lock everything down so that she's unable to do any harm. And no one around can either intervene or be injured.
Okay, Grant, officers try to get her to surrender and drop the sword. They tried tear gas, they tried a robot, they tried a battering ram. Was all of that after she went into the garage where that became sort of the central focal point here?
Yeah, so they hadn't tried any of that stuff while she was in the house next door. Once she got in the garage, that's when they brought in the negotiator. They sent the robot. They did the tear gas. And before she made it to the garage was when they were firing I'm not sure if it was the rubber or the beanbags, but either way, they were trying to disable her with a shot there. So nothing really in the house.
How long did this sort of standoff inside the garage then go on? We're talking an hour or two or three or?
The garage part was about an hour to an hour and a half. I'm not 100% sure on the details there, but it was a significant amount of time.
Any theory as to why none of those different techniques worked to get her out of the garage? I mean, tear gas you think would drive her out.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if they were able to get it in there well enough. That garage is actually fairly large, so I'm not a real expert on tear gas by any means. So I'm not sure how she wasn't at some point ready to come out.
Who was talking to her, Grant, trying to get her to come out? I mean, was it one officer who took the lead, or more than one?
It was mainly one officer took the lead. He was actually the negotiator. He was in the truck that they put the shield up. And he tried for quite some time. Hey, it's going to get really hot in there. Just come on out, drop the weapon. We want to talk with you. And was very, very just same tone the whole time. So,
yeah. And did you think he was being as effective as he possibly could be under the circumstances?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if she was going to be reasoned with. So I think, what can you do at that point? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Dennis Kenny again of the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. There's no doubt that police tried several different ways to get this woman to surrender. They didn't work. Shouldn't they just have waited her out with three or four officers and let the rest of the officers go home?
Well, I wouldn't have used three or four officers. First, it's not clear the less than lethal options that were deployed, how well they were deployed, rubber bullets, beanbags, and so forth, I would have thought would well have put her down had they actually impacted her. Tear gas, as you noted, probably should have either driven her out or rendered her incapable of fleeing if it was deployed properly. I'm not entirely sure what a robot would do. The number of officers around is good to be able to, again, control the scene so that she's both unable to flee and unable to harm anyone. So it's not clear how the police handled this.
Can a person withstand tear gas, Professor? Do you know of a way that can be done that can enable someone to sort of withstand something like would have happened to this woman?
You can, not well, particularly if she had any sort of breathing apparatus, but that would be pretty unlikely. So if it was deployed well, then I would think that probably would have been sufficient.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about the use of lethal force last week in Kansas City involving an incident on Thursday that resulted in the death of 28-year-old Ashley Simonetti up in the Northland. Grant, through the several hours this took, how worried were you about your own safety, your own kids' safety as you were in your own house there?
I was worried when she was running around my backyard because at that point they were firing, and I didn't know what really was going on. I just hear shots. So when I'm laying on top of my kids, that at that point I'm going, this just got extremely personal. Mm-hmm. So that was the point that I was nervous. Once she got into that house, which, you know, we've been wanting that house torn down for a long time, I'm actually in a weird way glad it was still there because that's where she chose to go. And that is kind of a contained environment. Mm-hmm. And so at that point I knew it was pretty well under control.
And how were the kids doing in all this?
you know, I told them, yeah, we're going to take a nap. We're all just feeling tired today. So I told them to just lay down and, hey, if you want to get up and read a book, just make sure you just lay down. I'm going to turn the lights off. I'm just feeling kind of tired today. And, you know, they have no idea what happened.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. They have no idea.
They really were oblivious to the whole
completely,
thing.
Completely, yeah. Thank God.
Yeah. No, I get that. And did the neighbors know Ashley Simonetti?
It appears.
Was she known in the neighborhood?
Not that I know, not on my side. I know on the other side, it appears that she was known fairly well, but on my side, I don't think anybody knew her really.
I wonder if we can then turn to the difficult part of this conversation in the moment that the police actually shot her. She had been holed up in this garage, you said, for an hour and a half, maybe a couple of hours.
Yeah.
And then what happened?
Yeah. So when they brought the handheld ram to go to the side of the garage and go in,
Handheld ram meaning to break in the side of the garage?
Right.
Right through the wall?
No, through the door.
Through the door,
right.
Okay.
Yeah, so they went over to that side, and as soon as they kind of had made that motion, she came out of the left side, and the garage door was buckled. I can't imagine she went over the top. She probably went underneath.
Yeah,
I
saw a photograph of it last night.
Yeah, and at that point, she is running full speed ahead at them with the sword up, not like goring, not like slicing, but straight in front of her. She is full speed ahead. There's no slowing down. At that point, they are yelling, get down, get down. I mean, they over and over again, get down, get down, get down. And she kept going full force.
Right at the officers.
Right at two officers, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And that's the point when the shots rang out then.
Yeah, that is the point.
What was going through your mind at that moment? Did you think that what happened needed to happen? Were you thinking the police had overreacted? What were you thinking?
For one, it was just shock and disbelief. I knew it was in the realm of possibilities. Whenever I saw her charging directly at two officers, there's kind of a thought in your head going like, this is about to get ugly. You know what I mean? I don't think they overreacted because she is running full speed ahead directly at them. The picture's kind of been painted that she was running away from them. No, she was running directly at them.
And there's no question about that.
There's no question about that.
Yeah. Dennis Kenny, should police ever be forced to move and take action as if there's a deadline here? I mean, police were spending a lot of resources here. Does it ever make sense to think, hey, we've been here 5 hours, it's time to wrap this thing up? Or I guess what I'm driving at is, could they have gone longer here, just letting her sit in the garage?
They could have. I mean, the idea, again, is to control the scene. They've got enough resources there to be able to attempt to negotiate with her. It's not clear whether or not they actually made contact or whether they were just yelling to her. So I would say that there are some legitimate questions as to how well the scene was controlled. What the other guest just described of charging with a sword extended towards the officers would certainly suggest that at the point of the shooting decision, it was justified.
Hmm. When is deadly force justified, Dennis? What are some of the basic parameters here?
The general standard is defense of life. And so if an officer believes that either his or her life is at risk or someone else nearby is at risk, then they're justified to use deadly force.
Can that include the possibility of suicide, Dennis? If you believe the person who's being targeted might become suicidal?
If they're threatening only themselves, then it wouldn't make much sense to use deadly force. If they're threatening someone else, then it certainly would.
Yeah. How does the fact that this woman, again, Ashley Simonetti, she appeared to be struggling with some mental health issues here throughout this early afternoon that Grant is describing to us, how does that change the math here, or does it?
It might change the math in the management of the scene. If neighbors knew her and if the police were aware of that, then there would be some additional options to be able to try to negotiate her out to control the scene. By the time they got to the shoot, don't shoot decision, her charging with a sword, her mental state really doesn't matter at that point.
What other options are you referring to?
In what sense?
Other options. You mentioned that involving a woman who was struggling with some mental health issues here. What else might have entered into the equation as officers tried to work through the situation?
Well, the ideal would be if you can contain things, and then, as I said, had they been able to identify her through negotiations with her, family members, neighbors who know her, other appeals that might have brought her down to lessen the risk that obviously wound up resulting, any of those sorts of options. The only other options they would have had at the shoot don't shoot point would have been less than lethal beanbags, tasers, those sorts of things. And from what was described, I think this probably would not have been recommended.
Why not?
Not likely to be, or not sufficiently likely to be effective.
Okay. How close ultimately did the officers, did Ashley come to the officers as she charged towards them, Grant?
Once they had actually shot her, she fell very close to almost to their feet. She was very, very close.
Really very close, yeah. When a person is not a realistic threat to harm anybody but herself here, Professor, does that change the calculations here?
Well, sure. If they're only threatening themselves, then deadly force really wouldn't be called for. Mm-hmm. Other alternatives. Obviously, if they committed suicide, that would be unfortunate, but there's no need for you to do it for them.
Yeah. Grant, you told the Star that you were convinced that police had acted appropriately here. I'm wondering why.
Due to the fact that she was charging directly at them with the sword, I'm not an expert on tasers or anything like that, but if somebody's coming directly at you and it's a URI situation, I believe that's what they're trained to do, is they got to do what they have to do at that point. I'm not excited about it. There was no winners there. It wasn't exciting by any means.
You know, we tend to second guess police in these situations a lot. What would you tell us about that? Because obviously you weren't there. I wasn't there. I'm guessing that it's awfully easy to play armchair quarterback in cases like this.
It is. Obviously, the use of deadly force is something that we want police to do very carefully and only as a last resort. That said, they are in the position of having to make the determination of whether or not a life needs to be defended, and how well they're trained and what their options are is what's really important here. I don't know in this case what the training for the police was, but it doesn't sound as though their options once she left the shed were plentiful.
You know, the Star editorial board, the newspaper here, Professor, that I serve on, has called for an independent review of a police shooting like this. Is that standard practice? Because here, the department often conducts its own internal reviews. And I think what the editorial board was suggesting was an outside consultant coming in and looking at this. What would be the procedure that you would recommend?
I don't know that it has to be an outside consultant, but certainly I would argue that in almost all shooting cases, deadly or not, some sort of an independent review of the facts would be important to conduct. If nothing else, just to reassure the public that the investigation was fair and impartial and that the rules are being applied properly to the police.
And I'm wondering, Dennis, is it possible for a department to do its own review and still consider that to be an independent review?
It's certainly the case that departments should do their own reviews. There should, in any sort of incident like that, even down to a police pursuit, there should be after-action reviews to determine, did we handle things appropriately? You could argue, for example, that the shooting decision in this case was appropriate, but still argue that the departmental procedures leading up to it were not, and that therefore additional training and different additional procedures and those sorts of things are necessary so that you can avoid the shooting decision. The Miami police have spent a good deal of time and energy focused on the events that lead up to the shooting decision, even in the case where the shooting decision is justified.
And Professor, let me just try this one more time. So what would constitute, in your mind, an independent review? Can a department conduct a review of a case like this and still have it qualify as being something of an independent look back?
Well, I don't think it would be considered independent if the department itself did the review, which, right. as I said, they should do anyway.
Right, right.
Some sort of an outside body that has oversight responsibility. It could be a state police investigative unit. It could be a prosecutor. Some agencies have civilian review boards or panels that have that capability. And you could use an outside consultant if there was reason to be concerned.
Right. You know, Grant, it's been, 5 days now since this incident. Have you had any second thoughts about your own thoughts on what occurred that day?
Not with their decision, but just with how she got to this place. Mm-hmm. From what I understand, she had been failed multiple times by the mental health system. I know her mom tried to get her a lot of help, and so, you know, I don't have 100% details on that, but I do know that she was a very troubled individual. You know, Facebook information is public, of course, and she had some very, very troubling Facebook posts that I wouldn't share the content on air.
The subjects of which were what, without going into the content, but
killing cops.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, how to make pipe bombs, things, and very graphic language about. Killing people, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I appreciate you coming in, Grant, and sharing your thoughts about what happened that day. I'm sure it was not a memory that you want to hang on to forever, but you may not have any choice. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been pretty traumatic. The nights are kind of difficult. During the day, I'm generally fine, but you know, I'm glad it was me that saw it and not my wife. My wife just happened to be getting a haircut and I was on daddy duty. So I'm glad it was me and not her.
That's Grant Bratton, a neighbor and an eyewitness to this incident last Thursday in the Northland. Dennis Kenny, a professor from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, thank you very much for your time.
That conversation with Steve Kraske originally aired last month. When we come back, we will talk about that last thought that Grant Bratton expressed in that interview. When a person is obviously troubled, when mental health issues are publicly present, what exactly can be done? And how do local social services help those who seek out assistance? And what can be done for those who don't? Stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the program, we learned about the young women who helped desegregate America's schools. You can hear their stories at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, there are plenty of issues that might concern citizens of India visiting Kansas City to work or study. Gun violence, racism, the current political climate. What have been their experiences and their worries? Join us for that conversation tomorrow on Up to Date. We're talking today about the state of mental health care in the Kansas City Metro. In the first half of our show, we heard a conversation about a police shooting of a mentally ill woman in the Northland. The truth is that most mental health care situations do not involve encounters with police. Millions of Americans struggle with serious mental health issues, many of which go untreated, often with long-term effects that don't make the headlines. Joining us to talk about how local communities provide mental health care, what's working and what may not be, are leaders of the central programs in several metro counties. Tim DeWeese is director of Johnson County Mental Health Center in Johnson County, Kansas. Tim, welcome.
Thank you.
Bruce Eddy is executive director of Community Mental Health Fund. That's in Jackson County. Bruce, welcome to you.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
And Tom Patrizo is the CEO of Tri-County Mental Health. They serve Clay and Platte and Ray counties. Tom, welcome to you.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So we heard in the first half of this show a conversation about that Northland incident, the woman who had posted things on Facebook, who came out wielding a large Japanese sword. I'm not a professional, but it was apparently clear that she had some mental health issues going untreated, apparently. How serious a problem, Tom, is untreated mental health issues in our community?
Well, it's a pretty significant problem because when you think about the national data that one out of five individuals in any given year will have a mental health diagnosis that requires treatment, yet only about a third of them will actually engage in treatment. Mm-hmm. There is an unmet need there, and that's true locally as well as nationally. That data holds up.
You know, Bruce, in a case like that one, which made the headlines, where a person may be acting out, may be demonstrating some issues, but where they haven't come forward themselves seeking help, what can be done before something comes to a confrontation with police?
Well, the first thing to say is that people with mental illness are far more likely to be victims of violent crime than perpetrators of violent crime. And I think that's something that we always try to emphasize. Mm-hmm.
If they find themselves in that situation, having issues that are identifiable but which haven't been treated, what is to be done? What is the first step for someone in that situation?
We're pretty fortunate in the Kansas City area because there are a lot of resources, and so provided that the individual is interested in receiving care, there is a lot we can do.
And yet, Tim DeWeese, a lot of people don't seek that care or don't receive it. What are the barriers that keep people from getting the help they need?
Well, I think there's a number of barriers. I think the number one barrier that we often struggle with is that of stigma, the stigma associated with seeking help. I think the other piece is just access to health care. While we do have a lot of resources, access to those resources are difficult. For example, 60% of the adults that we serve are uninsured. And that is one reason that access is difficult. Even when you do have insurance, though, mental health parity is an issue as well. So I think access, while we have a lot of resources, access to good care and immediate access to care is always a barrier.
And when you say mental health parity, you're referring to the insurance covering mental health issues in the same way they would cover other.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let me ask, each of you works with an organization that serves thousands of people each year, but I'm not sure a lot of people know exactly what you do. Tom, Tri-County Mental Health, is this a government agency? What is it?
No, we're a separate nonprofit Missouri corporation and a 501c3 tax-exempt organization, and we serve the three counties, Clay, Platt, and Ray in the Northland.
You have kind of a special relationship with the county governments, though?
We do, and we are a contractor of the county to provide services to people who are uninsured, and we're also a contractor of the state of Missouri to provide services to people who are uninsured or have Medicaid.
Yeah. Bruce Eddy, does it work kind of the same way in Jackson County?
Pretty similar. In my role, the Community Mental Health Fund is in Jackson County. It's a voter-approved fund, and we provide financial support to about 35 organizations in Jackson County, and we serve on average about 15,000 folks a year.
So you're not providing direct care yourself at your office?
No. So I'm a funder, and we work with a bunch of agencies that provide the care.
So Tim DeWeese in Johnson County, how does that work? Does your agency provide mental health care, or does it direct people to other places they can get help?
Both. Okay. So we are actually a licensed community mental health center from the state. But we are pretty unique. There's only two counties in the state of Kansas that actually the community mental health centers are actually part of county government. So I am a director of a county department. So Johnson County Mental Health Center is a department of Johnson County government. And so we receive quite a bit of funding from the county. And so we have, in that essence, we provide services to those individuals that have no insurance, that are underinsured or uninsured. And then we also provide those services to those individuals that have the most severe mental illnesses. But I like to also describe our organization as the gateway to mental health services. So if someone has a mental health issue, they can come to us. We'll determine what the best level of care for them would be, and then we'll get them connected with one of our community partners if we don't provide the services ourselves.
You know, we keep using the term mental health services, mental health issues, mental health problems, but what is the range of things that we're talking about here?
Yeah,
do you deal with? Tom, Patrice?
That's a good one. So, you know, at least for Tri-County Mental Health, we're called Tri-County Mental Health, but we're providing mental health services, which are the traditional ones that you think about, like psychiatry, counseling
medicine.
Medicine, right. But then we're doing a whole host of community-based services. And that's one thing I'd like to emphasize is that the more community-based services that we can do, that means we have clinical staff embedded in schools, health departments, other places in the community. We are a liaison with law enforcement to help them when they encounter folks that are struggling with a mental health challenge.
And is it anyone with a mental health challenge, or is there a level of seriousness that it has to rise to be in your care?
There is criteria that it has to rise to for us to be involved. And it also has to do with their level of ability to pay or not ability to pay.
I want to invite our listeners to the conversation. If you have questions or comments about how mental health care is being addressed in our region, whether it's your own experience or what you've seen and heard, give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888 to talk with the leaders of several mental health social services providers in the Kansas City metro. Bruce Eddy, a lot of people, we heard the number 1 in 5 folks may be dealing with mental health challenges. How many people are actually coming in and seeking help in the metro, whether it be from their own providers or from the kinds of services your agency's providing?
It's a great question, and it's difficult for me to answer. I think there are a lot of folks waiting for care. What I can tell you from our perspective is how many are getting it with assistance from the Community Mental Health Fund, and it's right about 15,000 in Jackson County.
Every year in Jackson County?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of people, but then again, it's a pretty small percentage of the population.
It is.
Does that mean that there's a lot that's going untreated?
Certainly it does, yes.
In Johnson County, similar situation?
Absolutely. I would estimate that we're serving about half the population that really needs the services. At Johnson County Mental Health Center, we serve about 10,000 county residents each year, and based on those estimations, we're likely to just be serving about half of the total population.
And what makes the difference? Why does someone come to you instead of trying to solve this on their own or not coming in?
Well, I think that has some to do with the stigma of seeking help. But I also think that it's more about making sure that people are aware that we exist in the community. I can't tell you how many times after an incident where I'm talking with a family member or talking with someone, and they say, well, I didn't even know that the Community Mental Health Center exists. So I think taking opportunities like we are today to talk about community mental health, making sure that our community is aware of what we do, I think that is even a bigger reason that we need to be out and talking about what we're doing.
Tom, are there certain mental health challenges that come forward most often? Is there one or two dominant problems that your group addresses?
Well, primarily we serve people that have more serious mental illnesses like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, some type of psychoses. But also we do provide substance use services for people that have addictions. And what we see there is quite a bit of folks using meth, and then opioids is on the rise, as you've heard. So we do provide treatment for that as well.
Yeah, I wondered about that. Does this field sort of evolve over time? Are you dealing with different challenges than you dealt with, say, a decade ago?
Oh, absolutely. So from the mental health side, I would say we're dealing with what we call higher acuity, people that have more complex needs. And then on the substance use side, as I mentioned, there's a prevalence of usage of a certain drug that changes over time. And right now it's the rise of opioids.
Similar experiences in Jackson County, Bruce?
Very much so. I'd say maybe a difference that we have from what Tom described is that we are lifespan. And so we will work to assist, for example, children that are victims of child abuse that may not have the symptoms of mental illness, and we try to intervene early when there are situations of trauma.
And is that something that you do voluntarily because they've come to you, or are there times where you, your agencies enter into situations at the request of police or at the request of social workers?
Oh, absolutely. So the key to those kinds of services is being readily accessible. So there are advocates in hospitals and in courts and all kinds of locations outside of the centers.
I want to talk more about that, but I want to, again, invite our listeners to the conversation. If you have questions about how mental health services are provided or how particular challenges are met in the Kansas City Metro, give us a call at 816-235-2888, and we'll bring you onto the air here on Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I want to invite Patty to join the conversation. Patty's from Kansas City, Missouri. Thanks for calling in, Patty.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
What's on your mind?
So I just wanted to share some information as I was listening to your program, as I usually do. I am a volunteer and an employee for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. It is a national program. It's well known. We even advertise on television sometimes. And I am a facilitator of a local support group through the National Alliance on Mental Illness in Kansas City. And I just wanted to make that support group information available to the general public.
Tell us what does a support group with National Alliance on Mental Illness do?
So we have lots of different support groups. My support group in particular is for people that are living with and coping with mental health issues or challenges. And it's free and there's no prerequisite or you don't have to fill out any paperwork. It's just a situation where you just show up and we kind of all go by some principles and guidelines provided by the National Alliance on Mental Illness, but we discuss our challenges and our triumphs, and we just have an open weekly support group for anyone in the community. And I just wanted to give that information in case any of your listeners were interested and might like to join.
We appreciate you doing that. Thanks so much for calling in, Patty.
May I give the information as to where and when?
Well, actually, we're short on time. Can we direct people to a website? That's usually easier for folks to look it up. National Alliance on Mental Illness?
National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, Missouri. And my meeting is in Kansas City at the Westport Presbyterian Church at 7:15 each Tuesday p.m.
There you gave us the information anyway. Thank you so much, Patty.
Thank you.
You know, I do want to ask you, Tim DeWeese from the Johnson County Mental Health Center, how important are some of these groups, like support groups, that form around the area?
Yeah, so we have a very good relationship with our local NAMI chapter, NAMI Johnson County. We also have a couple other support groups, Families for Mental Health and Pathways to Hope. And I think they are really a key partner in providing services to our community. In addition, then I think it's also important that we look at the individuals that we serve. And there are many organizations, what we call consumer-run organizations, that also provide support within our community. So making sure that not only do you have professional providers, mental health providers, but that you also are partnering with families, individuals that are in their own recovery. And that together, I think, brings about the best support for individuals that are recovering from a major mental illness.
Let me ask very simply, Tom Patrizzo, we know people get referred by social workers in hospitals, by law enforcement perhaps, but what if someone wants to self-refer? They're listening to this program, they know they need some help, and they're learning that things are available. What should someone do?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So for Tri-County and for many of the mental health centers in the metro area, we have something called walk-in first assessment. So like at Tri-County, for example, on any weekday between 8:30 a.m. and 1 p.m., a person can walk in and they will be screened and then they will see a licensed professional
right there
and have an assessment done that day, so long as they're there by 1 p.m. And each of the mental health centers on the Missouri side, I know, have walk-in times available every day.
Do people have to pay?
No, not necessarily. So again, we're a contractor of the state to serve people that are uninsured. They will be assessed on a sliding fee scale as to what the fee may be.
So they pay as they're able to.
Correct.
Essentially.
Correct.
I guess the question I have is someone may be afraid to do that. They may wonder about confidentiality. They may worry that they'll get slapped with a fee later of some kind. Tim DeWeese, what do you tell people?
I think the first thing to do is if you need help, seek help and reach out. We offer what we call same-day access as well. I think that is much different than the mental health system has operated in the past. And that really goes to that notion of access. You need to provide services to people when they need them, not 2-3 weeks later. And so I think that's the first thing. I think the second thing is that during that process, we'll talk about those things. But the first the first and foremost is we want to assess what needs the person has and then try to provide those needs. We can talk about the payment and all of those kinds of things afterwards and definitely have those conversations so that individuals know what the expectation will be up front, so they're not surprised.
816-235-2888 is the number to call to join our conversation about the state of mental health in Kansas City. Alex in Independence, welcome to Up to Date.
Hi.
You had a question?
So it's kind of more of a statement, but also I've had issues with mental health in the past, and I think something that people who don't have that experience don't realize is that when you are struggling with mental health, it makes it so much more difficult to help yourself. As the sort of disease progresses or as your mental health degrades, you become less and less likely to get help for yourself. Now, luckily, I had a very strong support group of friends and family, but it breaks my heart to see so many people who don't have that level of support. And as their mental health deteriorates, they're just less and less likely to get that help. And it often sadly culminates with the story you were talking about earlier, where the police are involved, and just because that person has not been able to get treatment. So my question was, if you are seeing people who are not getting treatment, is there any way of maybe keeping an eye on these people or keeping track of them to make sure that they are getting some level of care?
Yeah, it's a great question, Alex. Let me ask you, Bruce Eddy, is there a way to track those who are not getting the help that they do need?
I think the most important thing that we're involved in right now is a lot of work to normalize the conversation about mental health. And so the gentleman that just spoke, I mean, I think that he made a great point about the role of family, friends, coworkers, in helping people to seek treatment when they may not seek it on their own. That's a major point, and I think that's part of our purpose here today.
Tim, you wanted to jump in there?
Right. I think one of the things that's really important to remember is that I think we have to take an assertive outreach approach. And so what I think you see across the metropolitan area, as well as the nation, is that you're seeing an increased partnership with law enforcement many times, and just first responders in general, whether that be MedAct or fire departments. They oftentimes are the people that first come in contact. And so as mental health centers develop those partnerships, I think we begin to then be able to have a referral source. We start to see that within Johnson County, we have embedded community mental health centers, licensed mental health professionals in law enforcement themselves, and so that we are able to provide that immediate access. And so I think that assertive outreach has to be the approach. So we don't just need to wait for people to come into us. We also have to go out and outreach and try to offer our services to people. Now, that can sometimes not necessarily be met with a favorable outcome, but we have to also persevere and make sure that we're offering those services that are needed.
Alex, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking today about the state of mental health in Kansas City here on Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Talking about the fact that you're making some effort across the area to bring about some of these changes and improvements. Tom Patrizzo, it's nice having the three of you sitting at the same table. How often does that happen, that the leaders from the different counties get together?
Well, actually, we were talking about this before we came into the studio. I know all the leaders of the mental health centers, me and Tim and the other five mental health centers in the metro area, we meet every other month just talk about what are some of the common challenges we're facing, what are some of the innovative things we're trying to do in our local communities. And I would echo what Tim was saying about we try as best we can to get folks be embedded out in the community where people are living and doing their work and going to school, because then you're going to get more of that aggressive engagement and outreach to reach people before the illness gets more serious.
Well, and do you feel like, I'll ask all of you, do you feel like things are getting better in how the region treats and handles mental health challenges, or because of increasing challenges in society, is it getting worse?
I would say our approach is getting better, and our ability to intervene with folks as early as possible through either those community-based folks or with crisis counselors that we have available. However, there's always more demand than there is for the resources that we have, and that's always a constant challenge.
Yeah, you think the same, Bruce?
I see that too. I mean, I don't have data, but my anecdotal experience is that there's a general trend toward higher acuity, people that are more severe and growing demand. But I have to balance that with the fact that in the field of mental health, we're always getting better. So there are new techniques, there are new treatments, there are great things that we're doing, and that's what keeps it exciting for me. So I think, you know, the short answer to that question is I think we're holding our own.
And Tim, you're actually part of the Johnson County government. Other groups take money from government as contractors, but is government funding right now sufficient for mental health care?
So I feel very fortunate in Johnson County because we do have a group of elected officials that understand the importance of mental health and treating mental health. However, I think that on the Kansas side, what we've seen over the last decade is really a slow dismantling of the mental health system. So while I think there's a lot of things, a lot of evidence-based practices, new approaches that are there and that we're providing, I think that the support for mental health services at the state level has really a long way to go. And so I really think we need to focus on that at some point.
We're almost out of time, but I do want to take one more call from Lynn in Kansas City. Lynn, thanks for calling.
Yes. I wanted to say two things. It's impossible to find a psychiatrist in Kansas City who will take Medicare with a supplement. Number two, I have had to wait over 6 weeks to be seen by a psychiatrist at Tri-County Mental Health.
Hmm. Yeah, well, that's got the director of Tri-County here. You can tell us.
Sure, no, and she brings up a great point. Thank you, Lynn, for the call, because there is a shortage locally and nationwide of psychiatry. It's particularly child and adolescent psychiatry, but I know she's an adult or sounded like an adult. But there's a shortage of psychiatry. We're constantly challenged with trying to recruit and retain psychiatrists. A 6-week wait, I hate to say, is not out of the norm, unfortunately, but that's just the state of the availability of psychiatry.
And, I mean, is that acceptable? Is that something that can be improved?
It can be definitely improved. Now, if it's a crisis situation, we would get the person in much faster. But for routine, that would not be unusual.
She also mentioned Medicare. I don't want to gloss over that. I saw nodding heads when she said it's hard to find a psychiatrist who takes Medicare, Tim.
So Medicare, Medicaid, and Tom is exactly right. There's just simply a shortage of prescribers nationwide and locally.
Well, we are out of time, unfortunately, but a great conversation, and I'm sure we could have had more questions. So thanks so much to Tim DeWeese, director of the Johnson County Mental Health Center, Bruce Eddy, who's executive director of the Community Mental Health Fund, that's here in Jackson County, and Tom Patrizzo, CEO of Tri-County Mental Health. Thanks to all of you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
It's an important conversation that will no doubt continue. On yesterday's program, the mayor of Kansas City, Kansas, told us why he hopes voters renew a sales tax to improve infrastructure and public safety. You can hear that conversation and others at kcur.org/up-to-date. Find us on Twitter. We're at @KCUR Up to Date, and I'm at @PTSBrian. You can also follow KCUR on Facebook. Join us tomorrow. We'll learn how one local medical school is using holographic technology to train students. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.